Okay, folks, this is Elvin Shamroff here. I want to welcome you again to our teleseminar, the last one before the submission deadline. So as a consequence, we're still going to be talking about tasteless issues primarily. And starting next time around, we will ease into oral exam technique issues. There's a subtle shift in the emphasis of these teleseminars. And that doesn't mean to say we will ignore tasteless issues, because oftentimes many of you will still have questions. You go through your cases and you realize, oh my goodness, I never realized I had that issue or this issue. And how do I defend it? What am I going to say? How am I going to present it? So we incorporate that into the oral exam technique side of things. So we will still have caseless issues, but we do definitely shift gears slightly and talk more about oral exam technique. Like I always start every seminar, this is unscripted. We have two people today who have submitted cases that they want to present and discuss. And I took a quick look at them. They're actually somewhat related, which makes this session really hover around a particular issue, which is actually very exam relevant. So it's really very good. I'm pleased. I also will share with you, many of you listening in will have attended our first live Definitive board prep course this past week in Los Angeles. And for those of you who did, I want to thank you. It was really a fantastic course, and the crowd was terrific. The attendees were just so wonderful, such a great group, and the feedback we got was phenomenal. So to all of you who attended, thank you so much. It was great, and we look forward to, for those that haven't yet come, we're doing it again, not this coming week, but the following week in Baltimore, and there's three more to go. Anyway, let's just check to see. Amanda, are you there? Amanda?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, very good. Thank you so much, and welcome. And Sophia, are you there? Sophia?
Yes.
Wonderful, and thank you so much to you too for volunteering. Amanda, I'm going to start right away with you. What I'd like you to do is just present your case that you're concerned about, and we'll chat and we'll work out how to deal with it. But go ahead.
Okay. So I have this is a gyn case list patient under post-op mm-hmm. complications, 32-year-old G0. With the pre-op diagnosis of pelvic pain and a known 15-centimeter left suspected mature teratoma, history of gastric bypass, and class 1 obesity. She was scheduled for a laparoscopic LSO. She got readmitted on postoperative day 2 for abdominal pain and was found to have an incisional hernia and a small bowel obstruction at the left lower quadrant port site. She was taken back to the OR by myself and general surgery for an exploration of the wound.
Did you say there was a breakdown of that port, or it was bleeding? I didn't quite say. What was happening with that left lower quadrant port? How did it present?
She came in with nausea and abdominal pain, and a CT showed an incisional hernia.
Okay, at that point.
Small bowel obstruction.
Got it.
Yes.
Okay, fine.
I went back to the operating room with general surgery for an exploration of the abdominal wound, and it was evident there that basically the fascia was at a point that it had split in two layers, which was not readily perceived by me due to her kind of body habitus following the gastric bypass and massive weight loss. So it was in an area that you would have expected the fascia to be in one layer below the arcuate line. But that is a soft tissue anatomical point and not a bony pelvis point. And so it actually was at a point the fascia had split in two layers, so the bowel was incarcerated between the split two layers of fascia. Thankfully, she did not require a resection, so the hernia was reduced and repaired by myself in general surgery, and then she went home 2 days later.
And you feel terrible because you missed the you went in basically below the arcuate line instead of above the arcuate line, and you feel that you caused the hernia and this presentation. Is that basically your concern? And I might be completely off the mark, but don't be shy. Was that the issue for you, or is there something else?
Well, there's a couple of things. I'm trying to keep this mostly brief, but yes, number one, believing that I was below the arcuate line rather than above, where, and missing that the fascia was in two layers at that point and causing that postoperative complication.
Just say that one more thing. You thought that you were above or below the arcuate line? Which one?
Below.
Okay, so I'll come back to that. That's what I thought you were intimating. Go ahead. We'll come back to that issue, yeah?
Okay.
And what else were you concerned about in this case?
That this was a 15-centimeter teratoma and somebody with a history of gastric bypass and high risk for spillage of contents, and should this have been done laparoscopically to begin with? And then the final thing, which I didn't mention in the initial run, is that the fallopian tube actually wasn't mentioned in the pathology report, which I did not catch until putting the case list together. While I'm waiting to hear back from the pathologist, if it's actually there, that leaves open the possibility of, did it get removed incidentally?
Correct. So this is actually a very nice case. I'm pleased you've got it, okay? Because it allows you, just by the way, folks, many of you have cases, the specifics of which are not the same as this case. This is obviously a very particular issue. But you've got this kind of issue on your case list. And I'm just telling you now, this is the kind of case. If you are not well prepared, can hurt you. Now, when I say hurt you, it doesn't mean to say you're going to fail, not at all. But you can leave the examiner unimpressed, and you don't want to do that. On the contrary, if you're well prepared, not only will you not leave them unimpressed, but you'll shine in their eyes. They'll be incredibly impressed. So it's cases like these, the stakes are high. And I want all of you listening in, when you've got a case that's potentially like this, understand the stakes are high. And so you've got to do what Amanda's doing. You ought to go through it with an independent person, discuss it, have them attack you to the extent that they can, from whichever angle they can, and do your best to defend it and practice defending it. And when you folks defend it as you go through it on your own, I want to emphasize lots of you will do that. And to some extent it's okay. But if you're going to do that, the best is to do it with someone else grilling you. If you're going to do it on your own and pose questions to yourself and then answer them, I want to encourage you not to simply answer the question in your head. I want you to actually literally speak it out, mouth the words so that you can hear it. Because what you will find is that when you think the answer out versus speak the answer out, it's really completely different. And you obviously have to practice speaking it out, okay? So with that out the way, let's just talk a little bit of specifics. What made you think that you could get a 15-centimeter mass out through a laparoscopic incision? Is that a negative criteria? I'd say the answer is no. It actually shows you got some comfort. If this patient were not, I think you said 32, if she were 52 years old, I would come down on you like a ton of bricks because you're concerned, you're missing the concern for malignancy, clearly. So it doesn't bother me that you didn't that you did it laparoscopically. And by the way, the surgery that you did was successful laparoscopically. So just as well, you did the right thing. And don't feel bad about that, okay? The next thing, as a general principle, virtually every one of you have at least one case on your list where you've done a nyxomastosis, given a ovarian cyst, an oophorectomy, whatever the case may be. In every one of those cases, you've got to ask yourself the question. There are a few questions. Number one, was there any concern for malignancy? And obviously, in answering that question, you've got to take into account the age, the clinical presentation, what are the features on ultrasound and clinically that make it more likely to be benign versus malignant. Okay, and if because a lot of you have written this up incorrectly, I know this because I've done so many case list reviews. You've either taken a 55-year-old and written nothing on paper to show that you had a concern for malignancy, and that doesn't look good. And I've seen the opposite as well. I've seen some of you take a 20-year-old for a presumed teratoma or even a functional cyst, and you start doing tumor markers and cytological washings and frozen sections. Both of those extremes are incorrect. So the point I want to make is, with all your adnexal mass removals, evaluate for yourself what is the extent of concern for malignancy, and make sure that that is reflected appropriately on the case list. Now, you can't, let's say you took a 55-year-old and you didn't get a frozen section, which is the case for most of you. I would say you can't, I would never tell you to lie, you can't make it up. It wasn't done. And that's also to some extent okay. But be prepared to address it, because it's a reasonable question for the examiner to ask you. Don't you think you should have considered the frozen? What are the pros and cons? So the fact that you didn't do it is not a bad thing necessarily, but just be prepared for the question. I come across a small but significant percentage of patients, of candidates, who have done the frozen section but didn't put it down on paper. And I will just tell you, 9 times out of 10, if you have done a frozen section but didn't put it down on paper, you really should think twice about putting it on paper. Don't leave it off. The only time I would leave it off is if it's a 25-year-old. Because keep in mind, this is a point for this particular kind of case, as well as throughout the exam. You can order whatever test you want, but make sure you can justify it. And if you're doing tests which are difficult to justify, you got to be careful, because two things. Number one, they can accuse you, and it's not a big accusation, they can accuse you of overutilization of resources, and they can also think that you're investigating this patient up the wazoo because it's based out of a discomfort level or an ignorance of this topic. So, you know, if you've got an adnexal mass, why are you doing an FSH-LH kind of thing? You know, let's assume there's no hirsutism. Why would you do that? So it doesn't inspire confidence in the examiner. So do whatever tests you think are appropriate, but make sure you can justify it. And if you haven't done it, you can say, you know, in retrospect, I think I should have. It would have been beneficial. It didn't make a case in this, a difference in this case, but I think it would have been beneficial. So that's the issue of the choice of laparoscopy. Okay, and I don't know how I got into the subject of adnexal masses, that's what it was, over-testing, etc., and to evaluate the level of concern for malignancy. Now, I don't want to get too cut up on the next point, because it's very specific to you, Amanda, but I'm going back many moons to my residency days. And by the way, for all of you listening in, the issue that I'm going to discuss is relevant for every single one of you. Why? Because every single one of you are doing laparoscopy. And what that means is you've got to know the anatomy of the anterior-abdominal wall, which includes the structures on the posterior surface of the anterior-abdominal wall. Now, Amanda, I came back to and asked you something, and I said, we'll come back to it, because you answered in a way that didn't seem right to me, but I may be rusty. And now all of you need to know this. It's probably, you know, somewhat new. Do I really need to know that? Yes, you do, because you're puncturing the anterior-abdominal wall. The arcuate line, my understanding is, and help me out here, Amanda, above the arcuate line, the rectus sheath splits to enclose the rectus muscle, both anterior and posteriorly. But below the rectus line, all the fibers of the fascial sheath run anterior to the rectus muscle. Am I correct on that?
Yes.
So then you answered the question wrong when I asked you, because you said you thought you were, now I'm getting confused. What did you say? You thought you were above or below the arcuate line?
So I thought I was below, a.k.a.
I thought, yeah. I heard you the other way around. I thought it was the other way around. You thought you were below, which means you would have gotten that posterior fascial sheath behind, posterior.
Right.
To the rectus muscle, but because of the bariatric surgery, you actually were above. Okay, that's fine. Now, so I just want to clarify that one issue, but folks, any of you who are doing laparoscopy need to know that. Also, I will ask you, Amanda, because this is probably going to come up for you definitely almost. Tell me about the anatomy of the inferior epigastric blood vessels.
So my entrance, to the
Just tell me about the course of the inferior epigastric. Anything about the anatomy that you can. I'm almost sure it's inferior epigastric vessels.
Yes. I believe it's, I will know this obviously by the time, but it comes from the external iliac and believe it's usually 6 centimeters from the umbilicus.
So let me just choose the important issues. I think you're right, and you're also anastomosis with a branch from the celiac artery, from the branch from the right gastric artery, I think, and they meet in the anterior sheath. The point is, it can be found. It runs if you're higher than the arcuate line. It runs between the posterior surface of the rectus muscle and the posterior fascia behind the rectus muscle. It lies between those two. So if you're ever doing, for example, which they can ask you, a Maillard incision, that's a muscle-cutting incision. And the one thing you've got to do before you cut the muscles is you've got to realize if you just blindly go ahead and cut the muscles, as you cut through the most posterior fibers, you're going to zap those epigastric vessels. So you've got to ligate them first and then go ahead and cut the muscles. And the way to find them is simply to lift up the medial edge of the rectus muscle, and you'll find it lying there maybe about an inch from the midline, between the rectus muscle and the posterior fibers of the fascial sheath. So just be aware of that, okay? And any of you who are doing laparoscopy need to know this, okay? All right. Obviously you mentioned small bowel obstruction. You and everyone listening in needs to know the difference between small bowel obstruction and ileus in terms of etiology and presentation and management, which is somewhat similar. There's one other thing, the tube. You can write down, and this kind of thing is affecting a few of you listening in. If you've got something like that where you think there wasn't something was missed, or something came up subsequently, you can write on the case list. And I would write it into the chart somewhere if you could. So it's a document. I would document post-op consultation with pathologist. I'm trying to use as few words as possible. Final decision from histopathologist pending, something like that, which shows that the examiner, there was an issue here, and you were proactive. Yeah, you didn't see it immediately. That's okay. Does it make a difference to the patient's well-being if you saw it when you got the histology report, or if you saw it two weeks or 2 months later? Does it make a difference? The answer is no. So if you put that down on paper, you introduce another minute of conversation, which is very easy to handle. And you can say, I noticed this afterwards in preparing my cases that this was an error, and I'm working on it. So you're being very retrospective. You're being prospective. You come across very nicely. So I encourage you to do that. Now, the last question, which is actually, in a way, the most important, and this is relevant to every single one of you listening in, because every single one of you have a complication. I mean, 99% of you have a complication on your cases, and I hope you're one of those 99%, because if you have no complications, that makes your exam a little harder, ironically. I'm not going to go into why right now, but that's just the issue. So, you had this complication. Amanda, my question to you is, having experienced this complication, you can now talk in retrospect, but I don't want you to do that. If you're to manage this same patient again prospectively, would you have done anything differently in this same patient? Take yourself back 3 months or 6 months, whenever you managed her. Do you think you should have done anything differently or no? And I urge you to be totally honest with yourself.
Absolutely. I would recognize that significant weight loss and morbid obesity do dramatically change markers that are soft tissue anatomical.
But let me ask you a question. That insight, and folks, you need to understand, all of you listening, the to and fro that's going on here, because it speaks to the psychology of what's going on here. That insight that you just mentioned, Amanda, is that an insight that you gained or better appreciated as a consequence of this case or not?
Yes.
So that's the point I made. Don't talk prospectively to me. If you were to go back 3 months ago when you managed this patient and you were managing her, do you think it was a reasonable approach, management for this patient?
I guess yes.
No, you don't have to, agree with me or what I'm suggesting. The point that I want to make is, when we have, unfortunately, bad outcomes, that's typically where we might, not always, we might change the way we're doing things slightly, okay? But the average one of us going into a case of bariatric surgery, we would be a little bit more concerned, and I'm sure you were, but it sounded to me like you thought you were below the arcuate line, which means you thought about this issue, and you did your utmost to do that. But the history of bariatric surgery and her still present some degree of obesity still swamped your attempt at avoiding that complication. So I would say you actually did well. You realized this was a potential issue, and you tried to avoid it, but you were unsuccessful. Does that sound pretty much how it was?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. You don't sound overconfident when you say yes, but I'm trying to get across the way people look at this issue and the way your examiner look at this issue. If you're aware you need to get below the arcuate line, but unfortunately you got lower than usual, but not low enough. Okay? No, hold on. You went too low. You wanted to go higher, but you weren't high enough. That's how it was. Okay? So the point is, what you did at the time prospectively was not unreasonable. And the best way to sum this up is, this complication occurred not because of you, but despite you. You tried to avoid it, but we're not successful. Okay? So that's the point number one. The next point, which is very important for every single one of you, obviously you as well, Amanda, where possible, and it's not always possible, but whenever you get a complication, you should always finish off the conversation by saying, you know, and you say this to the examiner in these words, as a consequence of this case, I now, whenever I'm doing bariatric surgery, I do X or I do Y. While it does not give me a guarantee that I will avoid going below the arcuate line, I think it will increase the probability that I do get in above the arcuate line. And so that's how I've changed my practice for the future. Because that's what they want to hear. They want to hear, every one of us can get complications. But when we get it, we do whatever we can, when we can, to minimize it in the future. And if you say that in relation to any complication that you may have, it really is a very powerful statement, okay? And I want to end off, the last point I want to make is, if you feel, and this case was unfortunate, Amanda, I think you'd, based on the way you answered, I don't think you're going to feel comfortable to say this, but if you do, then go ahead and say it. But for those of you listening, if you have a complication, you say to the examiner, you know, if you feel it's appropriate, I've given this a lot of consideration, obviously, since having it happen to my patient, and I've come to the conclusion that if I were to manage this same kind of patient in the future, I would do exactly the same. Because what that says is, I've used this expression before, shit happens, excuse the French. But, you know, we deal with surgery. It's the playground in which we play. And there are going to be complications. The best surgeon in the world gets complications. Okay? This kind of thing happens. And just because it happened doesn't mean it's wrong or bad management or bad practice. And you need to be comfortable about seeing it that way. So, Amanda, does this make sense to you as I've been talking?
Yes, very much so. And I think it's not for lack of confidence and not wanting to answer it that way. I probably mischaracterized it when I said it. My assessment retroactively is that this happened because I wasn't considering the arcuate line in that assessment. It's automatic things like where you make your left lower quadrant incision, and that is based off of the bony pelvis versus, you know, remembering when you are looking for a fascia. So I think it would be a mischaracterization of what happened for me to say that, like, this happened despite my best efforts, but it is certainly, like, as a consequence of this case, I now am actively mindful.
You do think stuff a little differently because you've got the experience, you understand a little bit better, and that's fantastic. Okay, so this I think it's a great case, and I encourage you to practice. The fact that she presented on post op day 2, that's fine. Be able to discuss the basic principles of a hernia in terms of repair, and even though I'm sure the general surgeon did it, and you were just assisting, but just be able to discuss the general principles. And I'm not really worried about the complication. It's what happened in the OR at the time of the primary surgery. So, Amanda, are you okay with that case?
Yes, I am. Thank you so much.
Sure. I'm very happy you feel better about it. It's a great case. All right. Sophia, are you there?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, Sophia, go ahead, present your case very briefly, and we'll chat about it.
Okay. I have a 44-year-old G6P6 who presented to me for a known left adnexal cyst that had been slowly enlarging since 2018. She's had multiple ultrasounds and an MRI, which showed a 11-centimeter complex cystic lesion with internal septation.
Can I interrupt you for one second? I'm sorry. Because I want to, you've got to use this for opportunity for teaching as well. Folks, you have it on this case, Sophia, but a fair number of you listening in have this on your cases as well. You've got an MRI. Now, any time you have an MRI, how much more so for you, Sophia, because you said an MRI and an ultrasound. Every time you've got an MRI, and the same goes for CT scan, by the way, in the absence of a cancer case where you're possibly looking for lymph nodes, you have to be prepared to explain to the examiner why you ordered the MRI. Now, in a significant number of cases, it wouldn't have been you. It would have been the ER physician. And that's okay, and you can say that. But if you order an MRI, you've got to be able to defend, why did you need the MRI? Why would an ultrasound have not sufficed? Okay? So this is the general principle. For all of you who've got MRI or CT on your cases, be ready for that. Okay. Sophia, I'm sorry, I interrupted you. Go ahead.
No, that's a great point. But yes, I actually did not order any of this imaging. It all came to me from the previous physician.
Okay, so that's a good response. Just FYI, when you say that, the examiner may still say to you, okay, fine, I understand. What do you think about the idea of getting an MRI and ultrasound?
Mm-hmm.
They may still ask you for your opinion.
Absolutely.
In which case, you've got to be able to justify it one way or the other. Okay, go ahead, Sophia.
Okay. And because the cyst was bothersome to the patient, she felt the sensation of fullness, she wanted to have it removed. She also incidentally had some...
How big was it, by the way? Sorry, how big did you say it was? You watched it over a period of time. How big was
it? Yes, it was 11 centimeters.
Okay. Over what time period?
Since 2018.
Oh, that's right. So for several years. And she's 54, I think you said?
44.
44. Okay, fine. Okay, carry on.
And she had normal CA-125, serial CA-125.
Okay, so you see here, this is very important, Sophia, for all of you listening. Sophia added that in now. Because I'm seeing hearing an 11-centimeter mass being watched for 6 years at age 44. And I'm starting to get a little concerned. Cancer usually will do a lot more damage and won't hang around for 6 years. But, you know, you can't observe these things for too long. And I would say this was too long. So I don't know how much of that time was under your care or someone else's. And again, if it was under someone else's care, you've got to be prepared to describe to the examiner what you feel about the care that you received prior to coming to you, okay? So go ahead. I interrupted again. Sorry, Sophia. Carry on.
I think she would have wanted to have it removed sooner, but she was unable to see a surgeon for most of those 6 years because of insurance issues, I think.
Wow. I've got to interrupt you. I'm sorry. So Dr. Sophia, if you had a 55-year-old with a 7-centimeter bilateral complex mass with excrescences and accretion of ascites, and she didn't have any means of paying her way or no insurance, would you just continue to observe her? For all of you listening in, maybe you saw what Sophia said was really a setup for the question, because she was saying, well, this patient arguably should have been taken to the OR sooner, but wasn't because of financial reasons. That's not, I'm being harsh with you, Sophia, that's not a very caring perspective. You don't come across well in the exam. So I'm just upping the ante with you. So I presented you a case of a woman with a concern for malignancy, okay? What would you do if she had no means of covering her surgery?
Well, for the example that you presented, that sounds, the case sounds much more concerning for malignancy, and I would refer that patient to gyne-oncology.
So you're just passing the buck. Okay, let's take it not malignancy. Okay, I hear you, because it's not your turf. Let's take it that it is a patient with a benign fibroid that is large to the point that it's interfering with her quality of life in a major way. So the need for referral is that it's within your domain of management. So you're not going to do it because she doesn't have insurance. Is that what you're suggesting?
No.
You understand why I'm bringing it up? It shows a callous. I'm not saying you're callous at all, but you understand the issue that may confront you and anyone else listening in. They can do this. You want to come across as comparing, concerned and compassionate and caring. So how would you answer that question?
I would do the right thing for the patient, as I did for this patient in my case, actually.
Because so what would you do?
I would do a surgery.
Okay, now she has to pay for the hospital and for the lab and for the anesthesiologist and for the histopathologist and the OR.
Mm-hmm.
She says, I can't do that. What are you going to do?
Well, that is part of the reason why we usually want patients to have insurance, because there are a lot of associated costs. And so I would want to try to help her get insurance.
Fine. If everyone wants to have insurance, this patient doesn't. What? You're trying to ease your way out of confronting the question, but I'm bringing you back to it for a purpose. I want you to have to face this. It's an unpleasant conversation. So what are you going to say?
For this case?
I can't hear you. Say again.
For which question would you like me to answer?
What are you going to do if the patient cannot afford all the services that are required for her to have this surgery, which will change her life dramatically, but she can't afford it for financial reasons? Can you help her or not?
I would try to help her get insurance, or I would have her go to the hospital.
Or you'd have to what? I didn't hear the last something about the hospital.
Have her go through the emergency room if it is that severe.
Okay, that's fine. So you can also say, I will speak to, you just got to say something that shows you're going to go a little bit out of your way to try and help this woman. So I would speak to the hospital administrator. I would speak to the local charitable organizations. I would try and help her get insurance. Say something to show I would offer my services for free. I would try and get likewise with the other services. The only point I'm getting at is don't freeze on the question. Say anything sounds reasonable. That's all.
Oh, I did say that I would help her get insurance. I said that earlier, but it
yes, you
like
did.
That
but this, you did. Yes, there are a lot of other things that you can bring into the conversation as well. Okay, you can go to her local church and ask the priest there, the father, can the community help out here? Yeah, I'm just thinking aloud with you, but I don't want you folks to be too rigid. I want you to just be expansive in your thinking, okay? And what you answered was not wrong, not at all. But I'm trying to develop the point here that I don't want you to come across as letting financial matters get in the way. You've got to be very careful if they. It's a curved ball for you, but they can throw it your way. So just be aware of that. Okay, let's get back. You haven't finished presenting the case. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Sophia. Carry on.
Yes, and I would say, for the record, I didn't observe her at all, actually. So as soon as she got into my office, then we did her surgery not too long afterwards.
Excellent, excellent. So you're basically, I'm playing the role of examiner here. You're basically in agreement with me. She should have had a surgery a long time ago, and all you could do was to do it as soon as possible, which is what you did. So say that in the exam, in essence. Okay, carry on.
And then when we did the diagnostic laparoscopy, there was the uterus and ovaries were visualized and they were normal. There was no cyst, and it appeared that it was completely retroperitoneal.
Okay. So I will just share with you, when I read your case, because I got this case on email, I can tell you I had this exact similar case many, many moons ago. So I know what it's like, and it's not fun opening up and finding nothing. So, Dr. Sophia, what do you think? Do you think you screwed up? Do you think you subjected this patient to unnecessary surgery? I'm purposely being harsh with you to make you freak out, because it's not nice to be accused of doing unnecessary surgery. So I'm doing it intentionally. I'm not saying that's how I feel, but go ahead.
Sure. Well, imaging is not perfect, and sometimes you can't see where the beginning of the cyst is. And based on the knowledge that I had, it appeared that it was ovarian, somewhat adnexal or ovarian in nature, which would be well within our purview.
Okay, and I'm posing the same question to you as I did to Amanda. If you were to see this exact same patient, okay, and were managing her prospectively, take yourself back however many months, would you do her anything differently, or do you think your management that you gave was appropriate for what you had?
Yes, to the best of my knowledge, it appeared to be an ovarian adnexal cyst, and it was not. But I don't, I don't know.
Would you manage her the same way again, prospectively, not with the advantage of hindsight?
Yes.
And that's the correct answer. And you need to say that, folks, in the exam. You say, manage in hindsight. Obviously, I wish that this wouldn't have happened. But that's with the advantage of hindsight. Managing prospectively, I've looked at this many, many different angles, and I've come to the conclusion, I think given the information that I had, I would be obligated to go in. Okay? Now, there's one other question that you've got to be prepared to address. Some of us do it, some of us don't. Do you perform an EUA prior to performing a surgery?
You mean in the office or immediately prior to the surgery in the operating room?
Yeah. Under anesthesia. She's asleep and you go ahead and do a pelvic exam.
Yes.
You do? Okay, good. The point that I'm making is a lot of us don't, okay? But every single one of us should. So I think in a case like this, you should make a point of saying, I did an EUA. Now, if you're going to say that, there are two follow-up questions that come up. How did you counsel her preoperatively? Did you say, I'm going to do an examination under anesthesia, and if I find nothing, we're just going to wake you up? Because you've got to be very bold to make that kind of pronouncement. And did you counsel her that way or not?
I did counsel her that it was possible that we would not find anything during surgery. I did counsel her on that possibility.
Okay, but not if you had that suspicion before going in. You counsel that if you went in and you found nothing, you wouldn't do anything. But my question is a little different. If before you put knife to skin and you're doing an EUA, you found nothing on EUA,
right?
Would you stop at that point and just wake her up without putting knife to skin?
No, not in that case.
You see, most of us are going to go through regardless, okay? So just be aware of that issue and that conversation. And you can go either way with it, okay? I'm not saying one way is right and another way is wrong. But just be ready for the conversation. And the other point I wanted to make was, what did you feel when you did the EU? Could you feel the mess?
Yes.
Okay. So just by the way, this is, okay, at that side it's difficult to miss, okay? But I really don't want to encourage you, I'm not going to encourage you folks to lie, but I will say this much. If there was any doubt in your mind and you thought, I'm not really sure, is it there or isn't, just err on the side of saying, I felt there was something there. In retrospect, it might have been a bowel movement. I'm really not sure what it was, but I did feel that there was something there at the time. It's probably going to be easier for you, but I don't want you to be dishonest. Okay, just keep that in mind. So, Sophia, this happens. It's all you did was you gave her a laparoscopy, which was indicated but turned out to be negative. It's the same thing as a general surgeon going in on a case of appendicitis and pulling out a lily white appendix. It's the same thing, but you still got to do it. Okay, as long as you've dotted the I's and crossed the T's, you got a negative result, negative in more than one way. It doesn't mean to say the decision to go in was wrong, okay? So that's point number one.
Can I clarify one, this may not actually change anything, but there was nothing attached to the ovary, but we were able to see where the likely cyst was, and it was completely retroperitoneal.
Okay, fine. So you're actually leading on to my... No, it actually leads on to the next question which you've got to be prepared to answer, and that is, okay, she had a retroperitoneal mass, or at least it wasn't intraperitoneal, ovarian. After you saw her back in the office, what did you do for her with this mass? Because now the patient is left hanging. The case is not complete yet. So what did you do for her?
I referred her to general surgery.
You sent her to general surgery. Okay. In the exam, that's the right answer, I would assume. And but it doesn't end there because the examiner is going to be curious. And he or she is going to want to know, well, what did they ultimately find? What was this? At this point in time, do you know the answer to that question?
I wish I did. I haven't gotten any, consult report back or anything like that. I wish I knew.
Okay, so it'll be nice before you walk into the exam to be able to answer that question. And if you don't know, you can say, I've tried on a number of occasions to follow up with the general surgeon who actually did the surgery. To this point, I have not yet been successful, but I too want to know exactly what this was because I need to know for future. Okay?
Yeah,
so
Yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely. So, Sophia, are you more comfortable with this case now? Are you still anxious about something?
I do have an additional question.
Yes, go ahead.
I don't know if they'll ask me about the... did I review the MRI myself, or will they ask any questions along those lines?
Sorry, I didn't. Will they ask any questions along which lines?
For example, did you look at the MRI images yourself versus looking, just reading the report?
No. It's first of all, MRI. We're not expected to be experts on MRI interpretation. It's more than enough for you to take the MRI report at surface value. And I don't think your examiner wouldn't be able to handle that question because he or she doesn't do it either. In practice, the ultrasound, if you were to look at the photographs from the ultrasound, you're at a disadvantage as well because you didn't see the whole movie. You didn't see what came before and after. So you don't have the full context. So you're a little compromised. They might ask you, I can't see it, but there's a remote possibility they could ask you about ultrasound. But I doubt it, okay? I certainly don't believe they would ask you about MRI or CT. That's really outside of our domain. So I wouldn't worry about that. All right. Anything else on your end? Sure. Anything else?
No, those were the main questions. Thank you.
All right. Excellent. So both the cases were cases of complications that happened not because of the physician, but despite the physician. This kind of thing happens, okay? And you need to be comfortable to deal with it along the lines that I've suggested. Amanda, very briefly, are you still there, Amanda?
Yes.
I do this every so often. Please be open and honest. Tell us what you thought of being on the hot seat. Did you find it helpful to discuss your case? Or embarrassing?
Absolutely.
Okay, good. Thank you. Sophia, how about you?
Yeah, a couple.
Good. Look, the point why I do this, folks, is I want all of you listening in to be comfortable to hand in cases that we can discuss them. Like I said at the beginning, we're going into oral exam technique season, and this service that we provide is free. So use it as an opportunity to put yourself on the hot seat. You'll notice I've never, ever used candidates' last names. So even if I ask you a question which you don't know, you're not going to get embarrassed in front of people because no one knows who you are. So I want to encourage you to volunteer to be on the hot seat and also ask your friends to come and join. The more the merrier. It really is the case. So, folks, I'll finish off by saying I really think first of all, it's a little late to make a change in decision, but if you can avoid taking the second deadline, ABOG deadline, it certainly is preferred. Get it in by the end of the month, and you're done with it. You'll feel a weight lifted off your shoulders once you press that final save button and close. I also want you to guilt-free take a four-day vacation, 4 days or so vacation, away from anything to do with the exam. You owe it to yourself. The cases is a huge part of the exam, and that is now behind you. So take an exam vacation, and it should be guilt-free. Then start up again with oral exam technique issues. Practice talking with colleagues, with friends, with us at ExamPro, wherever. But you need to practice talking and defending your decisions as much as you can. So our next teleseminar will be today in 2 weeks. 2 weeks, the 11th of August. Okay, that'll be our next teleseminar. And thank you, Amanda. Thank you, Sophia. Those were great cases. And thanks to everyone attending. I hope you found it very helpful. So that's it. We'll do this all again on the 11th of August. Thank you so much, folks. All the best. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you.